This is KBOO Portland.
Anti-nuclear activists across the U.S. have renewed hope in the possibility of a world without nuclear weapons. In September, President Barack Obama led the U.N. Security Council in passing a resolution calling for an end to nuclear weapons and the proliferation of more nuclear weapons. But the rhetoric has not led to action, and Obama continues to promote nuclear energy as part of his plan to address climate change. Meanwhile, the radioactive fallout from the world's first large-scale nuclear reactor, located just 4 hours from Portland in Richland, Washington, continues to fester and leach into the soil, groundwater, and the Columbia River. The Department of Energy takes a very matter-of-fact approach in their description of the Hanford nuclear site. While acknowledging that there is a problem and that the problem is massive, the government's description of the situation seems to operate outside of history or morality. In this clip from a Department of Energy video.
Following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War in the late 1980s, plutonium production at Hanford ended in 1988. Site workers are now engaged in the world's largest environmental cleanup project. More than 1,900 waste sites have been identified at Hanford, ranging from small areas of surface contamination to 177 underground storage tanks that hold more than 50 million gallons of highly radioactive and chemically hazardous waste. Hundreds of burial grounds, large areas of contaminated groundwater, and plutonium-contaminated buildings add to the cleanup challenges.
Tonight we will explore this historic disconnect as we take you on a virtual tour of the Hanford nuclear site. Stay tuned. We'll begin with Pete Seeger's song, Talking Atom.
I'm gonna preach you a sermon about old man Adam. Now, I don't mean Adam in the Bible, Dad. No, I don't mean Adam, Mother Eve made it. I mean that thing that science liberated. You know, Einstein said he was scared. If he's scared, boy, I'm scared. You know, life used to be such a simple joy. The cyclotron was a super toy. Folks got born, they'd work and marry, and Adam was a word in the dictionary. Then it happened. These science guys from every clime, they all pitched in with overtime. Before you knew it, the job was done. They'd hitched up the power of the doggone sun, put a harness on old Sol. Splitting atoms right and left, while the diplomats were splitting hairs. Of course, the cartel crowd up and put on a show. They're gonna turn back the clock on the UNO, grab a corner on atoms, and maybe extinguish every damn atom. Can't speak English. Down with foreign-born atoms. America for American atoms. Step right up, folks. Let's atomize world peace. But the Atoms International, in spite of hysteria, flourishes in Utah, also Siberia. The Atom don't care about politics or who got what into whichever fix. All he wants to do is sit around and have his nucleus bombarded by neutrons. Yes, it's up to the people, because the Atom don't care. You can't fence him in, he's just like air. And whether you're white, black, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be? That is the question. Yes, and the answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets their fustest with the mostest atoms. But the people of the world must decide their fate. We gotta stick together or disintegrate. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men could be cremated equal.
Last month, the Tri-City Herald, followed by a piece in the New York Times, reported that cleanup of the Hanford nuclear site in southeastern Washington involved picking up radioactive rabbit droppings. For those who've warned about the lasting effects of contamination beneath this historic nuclear weapons facility, they could only shake their heads. Rabbits that had burrowed through contaminated soil contained strontium and cesium, which emit gamma rays, back out of the area in their digestive tracts. Though the place where they picked up the metals had been sealed over with concrete years ago, the waste droppings were still giving off radioactive rays in places that had never been used by bomb makers. The Hanford site, located outside Richland, Washington, produced roughly two-thirds of the plutonium used in the nation's nuclear weapons arsenal, beginning in World War II with the top-secret Manhattan Project and ending in the 1980s. It's now the focus of the nation's largest environmental cleanup, expected to continue for decades. It's already cost tens of billions of dollars. The Department of Energy, which manages Hanford, has made the site more accessible to the public this year than at any time in the area's notoriously secret history. More than 2,500 people have received a free 5-hour guided tour this year aboard buses where Hanford historians and retirees tell the story of Hanford. You can also take a shortened tour on Saturdays of the historic B reactor, the first nuclear reactor in history at the heart of the Manhattan Project. With us to talk about Hanford and its environmental legacy are KABU reporters Chris Andre and David Rosenfeld. Both of them took one of the guided tours of Hanford this summer. In the next hour, we're going to take a virtual tour of the Hanford nuclear site, this time guided by KABU reporters who were there. Let's start with initial impressions of Hanford arriving there on the tour bus.
Well, Hanford is a huge 540-square-mile piece of barren desert. It's spotted with 9 nuclear reactors that are lined up along the Columbia River. In addition to the nuclear reactors, there are other processing facilities and other places where they were processing the plutonium. And, there's very little wildlife that we saw. There's also valves and monitoring pipes that are monitoring groundwater in various places that are sticking up all over the sand. One of the things that I was struck with is that you hear a lot of newspaper reports about leaking storage tanks, and there are, I believe, 70 or 60 some odd tanks that had leaked at one time or another. And what I didn't realize is that these tanks are really all over the desert, and so getting a handle on where those are is really a big task. Chris, you want to share with us some of your impressions of our tour?
Hanford is vast. It seems empty, and that's the really alarming part about it. As far as the eye can see, it's a rolling, arid, semi-desert landscape, punctuated by mysterious, as David said, pipes, valves, and those only indicate, and in some cases simply sticks in the ground with flags on them. Those indicate sites where there are known repositories of contamination. But what we learned on the tour was that these represent only a fraction of the contamination. People literally brought barrows full of contaminated material out, and they were told to bury them wherever they wanted. There was plenty of room. Hanford is, in fact, the most contaminated site in the Western Hemisphere, and it's arguable it might be, with the exception of Chernobyl, one of the most contaminated in the world. In 1855, tribes such as the Cayuse signed a meaningless treaty with the United States government that granted them the right to hunt, gather, and graze livestock on reservations in what would become the mother of all Superfund sites. Delicate networks of treaties maintained the balance of power among European nations for the greater part of their histories. So I suppose it's only possible to sign a treaty at a particular moment and in a particular place with no intention of honoring it, if that event is a tiny island in a sea of time. My most salient impression of Hanford was it could only come into existence outside of history, and the important events of the 20th century that brought it into being took place outside of any real historical context.
Yeah, and we do want to get into the context in which Hanford was created. I want to move into the tour that you took. It took 4 hours driving from Portland, and then you arrive at Hanford. And David, why don't you introduce one of the recordings that we're going to hear from your tour.
It was we're going to take you on a virtual tour of Hanford, similar to what we experienced. And so we arrived at the Hanford site, which is just a few minutes outside Richland, and we piled onto a bus, and it started to cover this 500-square-mile piece of territory. And the tour lasted 6 hours, and it was led by Hanford historian Michelle Gerber. And let's just take it from there.
So we are now, as we head north, we're going to be, when you're at the Hanford town site, you're 3 miles from the first reactor that we're going to see. Hanford had 9 reactors up along the horn or the top of the triangle at the north end of the site. And the one you're going to see first is not the first one built. It's just the first one we're going to come to. It's actually the third one built. Hanford built the first 3 full-scale nuclear reactors in world history all at the same time and started them up within 5 months of each other. Never been done in world history before. The Soviets did not have any reactors, did not know how to do this process. The British did not. No one did. We did it absolutely first. And these reactors at Hanford are huge. What you're going to see is a small fraction of the way they used to look, because in part of the cleanup, what we do is tear down a lot of the reactor building, and we leave just the center part, the center most radioactive part. And that's not very radioactive, but it is more radioactive than the other parts. And we call that a cocoon. And that's just Hanford's nickname for the reactor as it sits in its cleanup state. And it's gray concrete, but it's got a shiny roof. And the roof is a stainless steel alloy that will not rust. And it can sit there like that for decades until the future generations decide what they might choose to do with it.
What she's describing there, what we're basically seeing are big concrete structures. They just look like blocks. And on top of them is this stainless steel alloy that is creating a roof. And as Gerber says there, it's not what they used to look like. And this is how they've been reduced and they've been encapsulated to protect them from any disasters that might occur. And she also mentions there the Hanford town site. And this was a community that is within the Hanford area. And when the government decided that this was the ideal place to start developing nuclear weapons, they basically forced everybody out of this town and razed most of the buildings, aside from a few of them that they ended up using as, I think the officers lived there and they used them for various administration buildings. And now I don't think there's really anything there. And there was also Native Americans that lived in this area and farmers, and they were all forced to leave there. And basically the government went on to create a new history in Hanford that involved the nuclear arms race. And again, we're going to hear from historian Michelle Gerber.
Each reactor is built in response to an international event. So the first 3, B, D, and F, were built in response to Pearl Harbor. Then you have the early Cold War, the events of the early Cold War, the Korean War starting, the different events at that time, the presidential decisions, actions or statements by the Soviet Union. N reactor was built in response to Sputnik. So what happened here is that you're actually seeing a museum on the landscape, because every Hanford building is here because of an international event. That's why we say Hanford is the battlefield of the Cold War, because it actually came home here. Things were done here physically as part of the Cold War. They're different because, for one thing, they were getting bigger, more powerful. Reactors technology was on a straight upward curve where you had the first technology, and within 5 years you could do so much more. So they evolved that way.
Hanford really is both a cause. This is what it seemed to me as we went through this strange dystopian futurescape, like something out of a J.G. Ballard novel. It's both a cause and effect of World War II, and there was really nothing great or noble about the Great War. There are no good reasons to slaughter other people. World War II was waged to make the world safe for capitalism, and it worked, obviously. The war was fought not to defend European Jewry, it was fought to protect markets and secure natural resources. These are some points that everyone that I ran into associated with Hanford had failed to take into account or had turned a blind eye to. So a lot of blindness, snow blindness here.
Well, it seems like Hanford historian Michelle Gerber has a pretty value-neutral judgment on the history when she describes it in the tour that you took of Hanford.
Completely, you could call it that, or you could call it a completely amoral view. Nonetheless, it was with no trace of irony at all that she describes it as ground zero. This is Michelle Gerber now with regard to the tour of Hanford.
Well, Hanford to me is ground zero for the kind of history that I love. World War II, the Cold War, these are some of the most important events in our country's history, and they actually took place here on the ground. So here you are surrounded by history, historic buildings, and events that change the world on a daily basis.
In your opinion, how do people here feel about some of the moral questions or ambiguities around producing this very deadly weapon?
Well, when we bring visitors to Hanford and invite them to come and see what we're doing and see the historic B reactor, we also invite them to form their own opinions. And so every person is encouraged to learn as much as they can and then go home and debate with their own family and come to their own conclusion about what they think, because this is a democracy and that's what we're supposed to be doing, is forming our own opinions.
And what's your opinion?
About
any moral questions surrounding... There's ever since, I think, you know, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, there have been people who questioned the wisdom and debated the moral questions. How do you feel personally?
Well, personally, I believe there was going to be loss of life no matter what in ending World War II. And it's not a straight equation of how many lives would have been lost using one method or the other. That war simply had to end. The killing had to end, and people had to begin to get back to normal. That war went on in some parts of the world for 15 years, involved over 50 countries, and killed over 50 million people. It simply had to end, and it was time.
And now here we are with the cleanup here at Hanford and historic buildings, and it's going to be a national monument, as it should be. What do you see in the future as far as the cleanup is concerned?
Well, I personally am not that much involved with the cleanup. I am more involved with historic preservation. And I know that we have great plans to expand the exhibits at B Reactor, to change them and expand them to the point where you could go in and literally spend all day, and to make this facility on an equal par with the Smithsonian or any other of the great museums of our nation.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add to tell our listeners? Thank you so much. I've been speaking with Michelle Gerber at the tour at Hanford. Thanks so much, Michelle.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
And you're listening to KBOO-FM in Portland. This is a special on the Hanford nuclear site, still radioactive after all these years. You've just been listening to a little bit of Chris Andre on a tour of Hanford earlier this summer. Chris, do you have any comment on that before we move into the issue of groundwater contamination?
Well, the irony there is that Michelle Gerber goes to into great detail and great length, takes great pains to say that the killing had to stop. That seemed to be a key point for her. And in fact, the killing has continued. In many ways, Hanford represents the extension of war down through generations, filling in landscape in time with some really serious problems that we have no plans. We had no plans then, and we really don't know, doesn't seem to me, how to fix this one. Lots going on at Hanford. Not much is actually being accomplished, and it's very difficult to see how they're going to be able to contain this unfolding disaster.
So looking at it from the historical perspective, the contamination, one of the worst, most contaminated sites in the United States, right here in Richland, Washington. I'm here with Chris Andre and David Rosenfeld, both KBOO reporters who recently took a tour of Hanford. And I want to ask David to just talk a little bit about some of what you saw and experienced in relation to the contamination of the groundwater and how that's impacting us downstream from Hanford.
Well, right. The groundwater is one of the most challenging aspects of the contamination at Hanford because obviously it's something that we can't see, and it affects the Columbia River. They lined up these nuclear reactors along the river to use the waters to cool the reactors, and they would that water would come into the reactor and then flow back out into the river. They also this water would also become contaminated, and it would spill on the ground, and it would leach into the ground and contaminate the groundwater in those areas. And so today there are monitoring wells all over the desert in this area where they're measuring how much contaminants is in the water, and they're also cleaning this water and flushing it back into the groundwater. We're going to go to a clip of Richard Buell. He's a spokesman with the Department of Energy talking about the groundwater on the bus.
Okay, the groundwater question.
The question was how serious is the groundwater situation at Hanford. We have roughly 80 square miles of groundwater contamination. We have a number of different contaminants that are in the soil, and we also have a number of different methods that we are using here at the Hanford site to clean up that groundwater contamination. You'll see some of them in our first stop today, which is the pump and treat facility at the 100D area. The facility it's just what it would be, a pump and treat. You pump clean water into the ground, which then pushes the contaminated water toward our wells, which then we suck up the contaminated water, we treat it above ground, and then we put the clean water back into the ground. It's a constant process to push the bad stuff to the well so we can clean it up. You'll also have an opportunity to see some of our other groundwater activities. We are injecting into the soil things like molasses and vegetable oil, and it interacts with the microbes in the soil, and then the microbes in the soil eat the contaminants that are in the groundwater and render them harmless. And then we also have what they call a barrier technology, which is just what it sounds like, where we put almost like a wall of good contaminants in the water, so that when the bad stuff hits it, they interact and it changes the chemical composition, and then the groundwater contamination that is in that area also becomes harmless to the environment or to the aquaculture. So is groundwater a problem? It is a situation. We're certainly working on it. It is our top priority. Protecting the Columbia River is definitely our top priority, and that's what you'll see out here in the site just in a little bit.
Okay, so we're going to hear now from an engineer working on the cleanup of some of the groundwater. We were able to stop at this facility and observe some of the equipment that they're using. And this is an engineer talking about the groundwater. In the background, you hear a hum, and that's from the fans that they're using to cool some of this equipment.
Along the river is where they sited all the reactors. The reactors were used to produce the plutonium, and in that they took water out of the river, and they treated it with a material called sodium dichromate, and that material was used to prevent rusting in the reactors and other things. So it was an inhibitor, if you will, a rust preventer. Unfortunately, a lot of that material got spilled over the years, or got dumped on the ground, or was actually purposely put out on the ground as part of the reactor water, and that's created a problem with what's called chrome. And chrome is it's called chrome 6. It got in the groundwater as it's percolated down. The groundwater is only about 75 feet below us, and so now it's in the groundwater plume. And so part of the challenge is that material, chrome 6, is not good stuff from a human health or from a wildlife, and in this case, an aquatic health standpoint. So what we are doing is we've built, and I'll go over with you in a minute, a number of what are called pump and treat facilities, where we pump water out of that aquifer that is contaminated, we treat it, and then we actually re-inject it back into the aquifer again, clean water, if you will.
On top of the reactors, there are reprocessing facilities and other factories that represent different phases of making weapons-grade plutonium. At each of these locations, workers continue to scoop up contaminated soil and take it to a lined waste pit that's being set up. In the interests of keeping a safe workplace, once in a while they drive by with trucks that spray water on the ground. That's the idea there, is to settle the dust. From where we stood, the trucks looked like tiny little bugs in this vast landscape where dust is swirling up off the ground constantly.
For a lot of this stuff, I think what's interesting is that there's really no way of treating a lot of this contaminated soil. And basically what they're doing is they're taking it from one place, moving it to another place where they think it's safer. And this is going on at a massive scale.
And it just seems like so little to deal with such a massive contamination problem there at Hanford.
That's exactly it. Set in this landscape, it is so enormous, these 500 square miles, and it is essentially barren except for these hulking remains of the reactors and the tiny little efforts to contain it. It's not even, it did not feel to me or seem to me that there was much in the way of cleanup going on. It seemed more like simply a desperate effort to contain a situation that was beyond out of control, but lost in this huge landscape.
Well, and you had Richard Buell just a couple of minutes ago talking about putting molasses into the soil. It just seems like they're doing a very small amount to actually deal with this this massive, massive problem. So we do want to hear more on this virtual tour that we're going on of the Hanford nuclear site in Washington. And I guess we're going to go now to a description of the contaminated soil.
Right.
They're also digging up contaminated soil at the river shore of K area and B area. And trucks are running every day, every hour, bringing out the contaminated items that were buried. In the old days, when a pump failed or something broke inside the reactor, they buried it in the soil right out there. They stopped doing that. That became something they were not allowed to do after 1970. But as you know, 25 years of production before that. So it's a big job to dig up all the soil. There's over 12 million tons that have been dug up so far from Hanford's river shore.
You're listening to a virtual tour of the Hanford nuclear site. I'm Jenka Soderberg. I am here with KBOO reporters David Rosenfeld and Chris Andre. We've just been hearing about contaminated water, contaminated soil, and now I think on the tour we're going to move towards the B reactor. Chris, can you talk about that a bit?
Well, the world's first nuclear reactor, and where the plutonium was produced for the first atomic bomb test, so the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki in World War II, is in this enormous B reactor that we were taken to. And walking into the building and taking a look at this thing rocked my world.
Let's go to Gerber and as she introduces it to us on the bus.
So K area is still busy. Hanford workers go to work there every day. Usually you'll have about, 300 to 400 people going to work in K area every day. Most of the other reactor areas like D and just the demolition crews or the groundwater pumping crews, a small amount of people, a few dozen people. And then B reactor, which is dead ahead, is very special. B reactor, I want everybody to form their own opinion, make your own choices about what you think about all this. But one thing I don't think there's any debate about is that B reactor was an engineering marvel. Whether you think it should have been built or was a bad thing to build, that's okay. This is your own opinion, but I will convince you that the engineering is incredible, because you just won't believe that they got it all put together in 11 months, first time ever, and it all worked. And it is truly astounding.
So the Bee Reactor last year was named a National Historic Monument. So it's been preserved, and it feels a bit like a museum. And I have to tell you, we walked into this thing, and from the outside, it looked like many of the other reactors that we can see from a distance, in which we weren't able to go into. But as we go into this building, it opens up into this giant area, must be maybe 200 feet to the ceiling. And there is just this enormous wall, which is made up of pipes and knobs and hoses, and it just looks, and they're all positioned in the same way, but there's probably about 1,000 of them, I think. And this is a nuclear reactor. And in each of these, behind that wall, there is a rod, and that I think it's made out of steel, and this is what is processed to create this plutonium, and it's knocked out when it's created, dropped into a pool in behind this reactor, and then into rail cars that are then shipped off to reprocessing facilities. And you know, Michelle Gerber talks about how this is engineering marvel, and I do think that that's really undeniable. But I have to say, looking at this, I mean, I felt kind of sick, actually, because this is an amazing feat of science that they've created here. And thinking that what they were, the end product of this was a bomb that we were going to drop on individuals was just something that was hard to stomach for me personally.
And Chris, what was your impression then of the Bee reactor, the first nuclear reactor ever made?
It's an absolute jaw-dropping sight, and what Dave remarked on just now is absolutely true and characteristic of the philosophic stance that permits something like this to happen. To be able to say that it's an engineering marvel and stare at it with childlike wonder and awe is symptomatic of a world view that exists outside of history. If you have any kind of historical context to set these horrors in, you cannot possibly arrive at this value-neutral observation that it's an engineering marvel. Indeed, it is. But at the same time, something like this just cannot exist in any human dimension. You have to take it, you have to abstract it from humanity and regard it from a safe distance. It is an enormous thing. The Bee reactor does in fact go up at least 4 or 5 stories. It's a wall of writhing metal.
At this Bee reactor, the tour is taken over by retirees who had worked at Hanford at some time. They take you back into the offices where the workers monitored each of these fuel rods, and this place had multiple ways of shutting down if there were any sorts of problems. And the interesting thing is that they've taken so many precautions. There must have been about 4 different ways that it could shut down, from the smallest increase in temperature would create rods that would come in and cool the whole place down. And so we have gone out of our way to protect our own citizens from this reactor that we knew was extremely dangerous. And then in the end, what we did was just drop it on people that were not part of our country. We're going to hear next from a retiree that led part of the tour here. His name is Ernie Bitten, he worked there after World War II, but during the Cold War, and we're going to hear a little bit of what he had to say.
I worked here for 30 years as a project manager and an engineer, and I worked at the Fast Flux Test Facility and other facilities. And reactor, so I'm familiar with this kind of technology.
How do you feel working at something? It's such a marvel of science and ingenuity, and you know, the capabilities of mankind, but yet you're making a bomb. Like, how do you reconcile that?
The plutonium was used to make nuclear weapons. And at that time, the Cold War, which is not very well understood by your generation and younger generations, was a very real war. And we were afraid that we would be bombed by the Soviet Union. And there was an arms race, and they were making plutonium, and we were making plutonium. And because we both had that deterrent, there was no Third World War. So I feel good about it because it was part of our national defense. I was also on submarines for 8 years during the Vietnam War and the hot part of the Cold War. So I saw firsthand what was going on. And,
Steve Buckingham is another gentleman that we spoke with at the B reactor. Another true believer who unquestioningly looks at this technology and fails to see how its effects are amplified into the future. It's not as though this happened and as the roar died away, life rose from the ashes, rather that it was magnified down through the generations. Essentially, Steve Buckingham is a very nice guy. He's somebody that you'd want to go have a beer with and chat with and hear his stories. He himself is clearly moved by his own stories, as you'll hear in this next clip.
Do it again.
No.
It's just phenomenal. And the amazing thing is that the people who worked on it, they didn't only a handful of people really knew what we were doing here, but we had very dedicated workers. If you look at the workmanship, particularly in behind some of those panels in there, it's just they just were artisans and very dedicated workers, and my hats are off to them. I really am.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about some of the challenges, and that people didn't actually know whether it would work or not. Or
yeah, there were constant challenges, and you know the unexpected shutdown of the reactor after it started up from the growth of xenon. They didn't expect that to happen, and it happened. And they were able to figure out why and how to overcome it. You know, there's just a lot of things happened like that. And when we would have challenges, there was even just ordinary workers would come up with ideas and come up with ways to overcome these problems that we would face. It's my hats are off to every single one of them. There was a not of "we can't do that" attitude. It was "we can do it," and we did it.
Amazing people. Did anyone ever express sort of moral quandaries about bombs and human life and so forth?
Most of the people who worked here in the early days did not, and have not. I am one of them that am very glad that they had the bomb there, that we built the bomb, because I would have been in Japan other than if it had not been for the bomb, because I was in the Air Corps and I was on my way.
Did you ever hear of anyone who did express concerns?
Yes, no, but not here. It's, I don't like to call them names, but the I can understand, because it was a moral issue. But it was a moral war, you know, and when you looked, I had some very good friends that were killed at Pearl Harbor, and I get kind of choked up thinking about those people that, and when you look at the number of people in our battlefields during World War II, you cannot feel ashamed of developing the bomb. We lost a lot of good men. So the moral issue to me, there is no moral issue. It was what we had to do to win that war.
Do you want to just tell listeners any other thoughts you have about this place? It is, to me anyway, when I first set eyes on it, I couldn't believe that anybody at any day and any part of history could possibly build something like that. It's just extraordinary.
That's really the way I feel too. It was an extraordinary effort, and the people who, the scientists who worked on it and had the theory that they used, and their ability to come up with plans, the engineers who designed things. It's, to me, it's still mind-boggling that they could think of those kind of things. It's just almost beyond comprehension.
Thank you so much. I've been speaking with Steve Buckingham at Reactor B at Hanford. Thank you so much.
You're so very welcome. Thank you.
And again, this is a KBOO special on the Hanford nuclear site, still radioactive after all these years. I'm Jenka Soderberg here in the studio with KBOO reporters Chris Andre and David Rosenfeld, who went on a tour of Hanford, and what you're hearing are clips from that tour. And Chris, do you have any reaction to just that clip, the retiree talking about his experiences and basically justifying what was done at Hanford?
Well, I think he doesn't even seem to feel he needs to justify it. It seems integral to who he is and to his world view. And it seems that Americans are uniquely able to arrive at this kind of a world view because we've seemingly evolved outside of history. We seem to exist in this eternal now that allows us to accomplish something like Hanford, like the B reactor, without considering the consequences. Like children, very often are cruel. They don't understand that their actions do, in fact, have consequences. Magical thinking like this, it really trades in beads. It's like strings of discrete moments that are adjacent to each other but unrelated. In other words, you could have something like Hanford built and Hanford's children, so to speak, and see it as entirely unrelated to our problems today. I could imagine people looking back and saying, wowie, that was what? It was an engineering marvel, the cleanup of Hanford, which itself had been described as an engineering marvel. And that's how this kind of delusion proliferates down through generations. And that is my own, not just my opinion, it's my observation. And it's startlingly clear in the high blue light, of this strange landscape.
And the visceral reaction that one gets, I guess, standing in the midst of this B reactor has got to be pretty intense. I do want to talk now about the children of Hanford, the people who have been affected in the time since the reactor was built and will continue to be affected in generations to come. And so, David Rosenfeld, I wonder if you could introduce the next section of this virtual tour of Hanford that we're going on.
Right. One of the most horrifying aspects to the whole Hanford experience is that these reactors emitted radiation out of their smokestacks, and different people will tell you how much the government knew about this radiation, but it clearly had effects on the health of the people who lived in the Tri-County, Tri-City area up near Richland. And in the 60s and 70s, a lot of the people that were affected by this were called downwinders because they were downwind from these smokestacks. And mostly it affected their thyroid glands. And for many of them, they had to have their thyroids removed. And so they could be identified around town with scars on their necks from where their thyroids had been removed. We didn't really hear a lot about this on the tour for obvious reasons. But there was a gentleman on the bus. His name is David Barber. He lives in Walla Walla, who raised a question about something called a green run. And this was
I think it was in the 70s, I mean the 60s, where scientists were trying to see where this radiation went when it left these smokestacks. And this was years after a lot of these effects had happened. But even this green run itself, which is supposed to be an experiment, had effects on the population, and that's a subject of a lot of controversy. So this is David Barber asking the tour guide about this green run on the bus.
Where was that contaminated plume that was released in the 60s that they wanted to watch and see where that plume went?
A plume of gas. It was actually released December 2nd and 3rd, 1949. And it was from Tea Plant, which is down in 200 West area, about 8 miles south of here. We'll go by Tea Plant. You'll be able to see its 200-foot-tall stack where the gas came out. That was an experiment to see where the gas would go and how they could measure it, whether they could measure it down to minute concentrations. Unfortunately, the night they released the gas, clouds moved in, it rained, and a lot of the contamination came down pretty strong, pretty fast. It didn't disperse the way they thought it would.
Weren't there two plumes that were sent out? And I thought some of that gas went up into Canada and down into Oregon.
Well, there were lots of bomb tests set off at the Nevada test site where the fallout plume came up, traveled north, and passed through our area, but they weren't released from Hanford. Lots of gas plumes in the 50s. And then the nuclear atmospheric test ban treaty in 63 stopped all that.
So as Michelle Gerber clarified there, that green run was in 1949. That shows you that scientists were concerned about what was coming out of those smokestacks and how it might affect the surrounding area. One other interesting thing is that where these people who were affected, you know, they lived in Richland, and these towns really embraced the atom bomb, especially in the 60s and 70s. Was it the high school at Richland? Their mascot, I think, was had an atomic bomb on the insignia of their sports
teams. They had
teams.
The you know, the electron with the rings, you know, the neutron and the electron.
Yeah,
and it, everywhere.
Yeah, they were very proud of this legacy in a sense, even though many of their family members had you know, their fellow people in their community had been affected by this. So then I had a chance to speak with David Barber and ask him what he thought of the response that he was given on the bus about this green run.
Where do you live?
In Walla Walla.
Okay, so you're not too far away. It's kind of something close to your backyard.
Right, and we're considered to be what's called a downwinder, which means that as leaks, or like the green run, I believe it was, where they emitted some gases out of one of the units here, and they wanted to see where it would go and how easily it could be detected. You know, it went quite a ways from what I understand, more than what the gal that actually told us on the bus it did. I heard it went into Oregon and as far as into Canada and Idaho.
With health concerns.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, this was just a test to see what it was.
Yeah, and apparently there's people in Spokane and in some of the areas in eastern Washington that do have thyroid problems that some people suspect came from problems and emissions from Hanford.
Was your family in Walla Walla?
No, originally? I was from California. My wife was from Hood River, but apparently the one of these clouds went down as far as to Portland, from what I understand. So, I mean, that would be, it'd behoove you to do a little bit of research on that, but that's what I understood from, my wife was doing some studies about it because she had thyroid problems and was wondering if maybe this was an issue that that affected her growing up in Hood River.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the tour so far?
I think it's great. I think everybody ought to come out here and just and take the tour. I mean, it's a 5-hour tour, but there's a lot to see, and it's really interesting. It helps me just understand the size and the magnitude and really the importance of Hanford in the beginning.
What's something that struck you so far?
Just being here at the B reactor where we are right now, being able to just see this, as they were calling it here, an engineering marvel, that these people could put together something that they had just worked out in theory, and be able to put something together like this, and it just worked like a charm and did exactly what they wanted it to do. And they did it, and they built this huge reactor in 11 months. And that, to me, was just incredible. And you know, I'm thankful that they built it the way they did and when they did it, for what they did it for. So hopefully, though, we can get rid of all that extra, all the nuclear stuff now. It's not needed.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So that's, I guess, the end of the tour there at the Hanford nuclear site. And as David Rosenfeld and Chris Andre, our reporters who took the tour, mentioned, the people of Richland and the surrounding areas are pretty proud of the legacy, no matter what the consequences have been to their health. I think it seems pretty clear that a lot of people, both the workers and the surrounding area, seem that they feel it's somehow worth it that that they contributed the atom bomb to history.
And I think what David Barber was just saying there about his impressions of Hanford, I really agree with that. I mean, there's no end to the articles you can read about Hanford, and you will never get a sense for what this place is really like and how big this area is and how much area they need to cover with this cleanup. And I'd just encourage anyone to take this tour. You can drive up to Richland on any Sunday or Saturday and I think drive in yourself and tour just the B reactor. And you can set up a tour on the bus, which is free. And you can do that through the Department of Energy at their website for Hanford. And you can find that very easily on the Internet.
Their enthusiasm is not contagious, but it's definitely an important journey to take. It's really the 20th century, warts and all, laid out before you.
So as we wrap up this segment of the Hanford Nuclear Special here on KBOO, still radioactive after all these years, I wonder if we could just get some final thoughts from you, Chris Andre, on what you think the implications are and how you felt about going on this tour of the nuclear reactor, the first nuclear reactor ever built. And it's right near the KBOO listening area up there in Richland, Washington.
I suppose the scale of it in all possible ways, the actual landscape itself, the history of the place, the numbers, the sheer numbers of people involved in the original effort, the people who were killed directly, and the ripples of death that fan out from this epicenter were really overwhelming. It's just so large, and every aspect of the cleanup, the bulldozing of piles of debris from one spot to another, accomplishing pretty much nothing. The tiny vehicles in the remote distance spraying water to keep the dust down, in other words, to protect the people who work there. And you cannot help but ask yourself, no one was protected then. Are they really, in fact, protected now? It seems that there is no temporal context. This is not set in time. It seems to be set outside of time, because, after all, we live in time. We don't want to coexist with something like that. We recently, in many ways, it's only a people or a nation that you can exist in that kind of an amoral political universe if you eliminate history and simply act out of this sort of naive ignorance of very young children who could easily, you know, pull wings off flies, as the apocryphal story goes. So in the end, for me anyway, Hanford's eerie emptiness contains so many human stories and so many vanished worlds that in this enormous moral and physical void, seems to be teeming with various storylines. And res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself.
And after that, hearing all of the parts of the contamination, the fact that this is going to continue contaminating for hundreds of thousands of years, no matter what amount of cleanup is done at this time. And now that the government is considering dumping mercury onto the site, saying, well, it's contaminated already, so we're going to go ahead and just dump some more contaminants on there. Well, it can seem pretty hopeless, and I do want to move people into the realm of hope and change and understand that there are people who have been working for decades to try and get Hanford cleaned up, to deal with the situation, to try to make this area safe for future generations. And there is a group called Hanford Watch that's been very active on that front. So we're going to hear from Paige Knight. Hanford Watch is a local organization that has been working to keep an eye on Hanford and to push for a real cleanup of this area. We'll begin with Dig a Hole in the Ground by the Heart of the Appaloosa.
Here's so many rumors, sometimes you get confused. But I read it in Time magazine, and I heard it on the news. We'll see dramatic changes in the lifestyle we enjoy if those megatons of atom bombs are actually deployed. The scenarios are scary, oh, but they don't worry me, since I received a pamphlet from a federal agency. It's got diagrams and checklists, and I read it front to back, and it told me what to do in case of nuclear attack. Just dig a hole in the ground, climb right on down, lay some boards on top of you and sprinkle dirt around. You have to be dead if you only plan ahead. You'll be glad you kept a shovel on hand. Now you can't just go picking any old place to dig your hole. Got to take a ride to the countryside, to the town where you are told. If your plates are odd numbered, please don't panic, you'll be fine. Just politely let those even-numbered cars go first in line. If you don't have a car, just hail a cab or ride your bike. You can climb aboard the Amtrak train, sit back, enjoy the sights. You and thousands of your city friends will be welcomed cordially by town folk who will show you country hospitality. Then dig a hole in the ground, climb right on down, lay some boards on top of you and sprinkle dirt around. Be dead. If you only plan ahead, you'll be glad you kept the shovel on hand. We're sure to give you notice up to 7 days before, but it's wise to recognize the warning signs of nuclear war. If the temperature is rising in a flash of blinding light, grab your toothbrush and a flashlight and shut the windows tight. If the wind is blowing wicked and there's buildings in the air, blisters on your body, fire in your hair. If the Tupperware is melting and your dinner plans are wrecked, stay calm, it's time to put this foolproof plan into effect. Just dig a hole in the ground, climb right on down, lay some boards on top of you and sprinkle dirt around. You won't have to be dead. If you only plan ahead, you'll be glad you kept a shovel on hand.
Let's dig it one more time.
Hole in the ground.
Attention,
right,
this
down
is not a test. Implement emergency preparedness plan immediately.
You will
repeat,
to be
this is not a
if
test.
You only plan
implement
ahead,
emergency preparedness plan immediately.
Hand.
Attention.